And a lot of young guys won't even know about it. But I think once you're able to get to a point and enjoy the moment, and if you can shock your city like we did in 91 for us in Atlanta, it's euphoric. And I think for Washington, they've been waiting a long time for this.
Schmoltz is a baseball analyst for Fox Sports. He was speaking there on Fox News. For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
This is Georgine Trinkle. I want to invite you to listen to Hot and Hunterd In every Monday from 4 to 5 p.m. You'll be treated to discussions on hot topics every week. Hot and Hunterd In provides a more in-depth look at issues that are happening right now. You can catch the show live and call in on what matters to you. Make sure to download the podcast to catch up on all our hot topics.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
Okay, welcome. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, yes.
Great.
Okay, and I can hear you guys. Good. All right, so welcome to the Hack Hunterd In Radio Show, number 18. I'm your host, Jim Minadio, and I'm the president of ZeroSurge, a manufacturer of power quality filters that are used for surge protecting sensitive electronics. With ZeroSurge, you have peace of mind that your electronics are kept safe. So today, we have our guests are from a New Jersey-based product advisory and custom software development company, taken from your one of your websites or some listing that I found, called TechNeed, right?
That's us.
Is it TechNeed Solutions or just TechNeed?
TechNeed is fine.
Okay, because your website says TechNeed Solution.
Yeah.
Okay, so TechNeed. Okay, it's Brendan Elliott and Craig Brace here. So Brendan's on the left.
I think right.
No, yeah, on the left. There you go. And Craig's on the right. All right, they're the founding partners of TechNeed. They work closely with their clients to internalize business goals and craft a sound strategy to achieve success in the world of software and technology, correct?
That's right, yeah. Custom apps, web and mobile apps.
Okay. And you also have an office in London, it said?
We do. We have a partner in London, yes.
Okay, good. Yep. And your customers are based U.S., Canada, around the world, or just?
Generally U.S.-based right now. A lot of them New York City area, but we're not really we're not locked down to regional.
Okay. And then at the end of the show, we'll have some historical perspective, as always. Today I stayed in this century. I usually go back sometimes hundreds of years for stories. In fact, it'll be this decade the story comes from, about lessons from one of the most widespread and potentially dangerous software vulnerabilities ever discovered. Do you think you know what I'm going to talk? See, I didn't tell them, so the audience doesn't know, or they don't know.
We don't know.
Could you think of what would be the most widespread dangerous software vulnerability?
From this decade. Specifically software vulnerability?
Yes.
Because I would say, okay, I was going to say the discovery of row hammering actually is pretty fascinating. That's a way that virtually any system can be compromised, but it's demonstrated in Linux systems.
Okay. No, it's not that.
No? Okay.
All right. So you have to wait.
All right.
And then, let's see, we usually do the weather. It's actually sunny, which is unusual. We had a streak. Actually, I had a streak for about 5 weeks where it was sunny, nice weather. And then every other day, it was raining, thunderstorm raining. So I didn't pull up the... Actually, I have that open, too, so I apologize for that. So it's 66 degrees here in the local Somerville airport, and it's going to be a low of 39, so it's getting colder every night, and... high 68 tomorrow. Nice weather for the next few days. So good. That's all the weather forecast.
Yeah.
We don't have maps or anything like that. And then the other news is to remind everybody, tomorrow is going to be the Hack Hunterd In meetup. It's not October 31st. We decided not to have it on the same day as Halloween. Figured that you guys would be busy handing out candy, at least, or trick-or-treating with your kids. So It is tomorrow, and this month our speaker is John Marshall. He's an intelligence analyst with the FBI. For 11 years, he was assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force, providing strategic and tactical analysis regarding homegrown violent extremism. And then since 2016, he's been providing strategic and tactical analysis in the cyber criminal threat. And again, we meet at the Lone Eagle Brewing Company in Flemington, right there off of the Circle, 7 o'clock. And the speaker usually goes on around 7:30. And then, we're, you know, first beer is free. So,
nice. Come on out. Good incentive.
All right. So guys, all right. So, tell me about your company. So, we have, so what we'll do just to, you know, give you an idea to remember here, a refresh. I'm just not thinking straight here for a second. All right. That, you know, we'll go over, you know, how you guys started this company, kind of your history about, I mean, because the two of your partners, you guys founded the company together, right?
We did.
So then did you guys, like, we could start kind of backwards from that point. So how did you know each other before the company?
Sure. So Craig and I worked together at a music technology startup that was based in Princeton. Mm-hmm. We got together there. It was actually a fascinating place to work. It was founded by a music professional, world-traveling concert pianist. But he had a vision to create technology that could read sheet music.
Oh, wow.
So we actually worked with some really pioneering technology in the space of convolutional neural networks to actually develop visual processing algorithms that could read sheet music. The vision was take your iPhone, snap a picture of a page of sheet music, mm-hmm. and it would play it back for you.
Oh, wow.
And then the secondary vision on top of that was to close that loop to have the software then listen to you play and mm-hmm. compare what it heard to what it thought it should hear.
Oh, that'd be pretty cool. That'd be very, could put piano teachers out of business.
Well, or you can really, you know.
Or help
enhance
a piano teacher.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the mission really actually was not to put piano teachers or any music professionals or educators out of business, but to give students the tools to improve basically their capacity to learn in between lessons. Because the problem is you go to a lesson, you see it, you hear it played, you try it a little bit yourself, whatever, mm-hmm. and you work on some technique. Then in between lessons, you tend to forget what is that exactly supposed to sound like? What's this little flourish supposed to sound like? Whatever. And the idea was to actually bring that up in between lessons so you had more continuous learning.
Well, that'd be pretty cool. I already am thinking that'd be something I always wish that I could have done because I grew up taking piano. I told you guys earlier I do play keyboards and stuff, but I grew up with the traditional classical piano lessons and things like that. So it was always a dream to be able to play something and have the sheet music, like have it automatically notated instead of sitting there by hand trying to draw it or whatever.
Right.
And so I never got into composing just because of that, just that hurdle of the monotony of doing that. So that'd be really cool to be able to. So how far did that go?
We did launch a product for iOS that could read sheet music. Mm-hmm. It was called MusicPal at the time. Okay. The technology was called OMR, analogous to OCR, but it's optical music recognition. Mm-hmm. The fascinating thing is it's really a challenge, actually. It's a tremendous challenge because the notation space of music is varied and complex, and there's virtually no tolerance for error. I mean, if the job of the tool is to get this 100% right all the time,
right?
You know, you can't teach someone the wrong thing in between lessons and have them go to a lesson and play it wrong, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, is there the other issue, the quantization of the music, like the timing? So the tempo, like I've done MIDI software where you'll play and then the MIDI will try to figure out what notes you did.
Yep.
But then if you played it back, you go, that's not what I just played.
So on the listening side, it's actually easier if you have a reference, mm-hmm. right? Because if you have the reference music, then you have to listen to someone play and try and figure out, all right, did you get the right polyphony here for like a chord? Or was the timing roughly right? That's actually easier than just freeform transcription.
Okay.
And even if you provide some context, you say, I want to transcribe, but I want this to be like, you know, three-quarter time or something like that. Right. Then you would know, all right, well, these are measures now because we think we're getting beats, the correct number of beats per measure.
But then how would he, I mean, like somebody like Tao would know this, so maybe you wouldn't know, but like somebody like a Horowitz playing a Brahms, you know, prelude is going to be different than Arthur Rubinstein playing a Brahms, the same exact piece of music.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes totally. Like, you'll listen to it, and at first you'll think it's not even the same piece.
Sure. There's sometimes a style.
So there's that, too.
Right. There's a style to the way that people play. And, in fact, we did a little side project where, in a similar way, we were trying to do predictive and generative music that would say, based on this structure in a measure, what would a given composer put in the next measure after it?
Okay.
Right? So kind of do some machine learning.
AI kind of AI music software.
Yeah, have it hallucinate music, basically.
Huh. But then you could use it for things like copyright infringement, too, then, right? Because then you could start getting into that, too.
To detect and find.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there are pretty good algorithms out there for that right now. I mean, YouTube really leads in that space. We weren't trying to beat any of those spaces.
No, but I mean, from even the concept, because there's the difference between, okay, you're playing the Beatles' Let It Be in the background of your movie that you try to do, and you didn't pay them for it. That's what YouTube
does.
Yeah. But then there's, people suing because, Tom Petty,
Sam Smith.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that he stole my song. So, but your software could probably do some of that too, or that
could
software.
Do some comparative analysis.
Yeah.
So, and actually, the fascinating thing was this exact discussion was one of the biggest issues we had in the company was focus, because the two pieces of technology, the computer vision tech and the listening technology. They were so interesting and compelling in a number of different areas, but any little offshoot of anything we just talked about is its own project that you could have put a team of 20 on.
Yeah.
Right? So staying focused is one of those.
And then if you have a leader of the company who's a creative person, he's going to want to do all these shoots.
The visionary people are always all out there, so you need a lot of ligature to hold them down.
Yeah. So both you guys were working there, and that's how you guys met.
Right, so I started there when the company was right at the beginning of a growth phase. So going from basically two engineers to, I think we had a team of
35.
Five or six researchers and a dozen software engineers. Hmm. And Craig came on to do business development shortly thereafter. Actually, one of the product that was, I would say, substantially more publicized and arguably successful was based on the spin-off technology. Mm-hmm. So we made I'm still not allowed to call it a karaoke app.
Right.
It wasn't a karaoke app. The reason it wasn't a karaoke app was because it used, Craig was the guy who was actually out there inking deals with publishers and
labels.
And labels, mm-hmm. To actually get the stems, to get the backing tracks for real songs. So you could actually sing in place of the artist and still have the backup vocals behind you and everything.
Oh, wow.
So that was a fascinating project, but it really just
used almost like, you could call it like 3D karaoke, or something like a term that's like an extra, or high def karaoke.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, there were a couple that came along right after that were very similar. There was Dub Smash, and there was Musical.ly, which I think Musical.ly subsequently got that turned into TikTok, right?
I think so.
Yeah. Or got acquired by TikTok. It was a fascinating app. It really attracted a lot of talent. There were very talented users singing in the app. It was actually one of the interesting stumbling blocks of the app was you would record, and you'd record, your video and your audio, mm-hmm. and it would actually post it up on YouTube to a channel that was created in the app for you, which you could control via YouTube and all the rest of that. You could you could monetize because you were using real backing tracks, but the fascinating part was that's a lot of exposure, right? So people were actually really nervous. It takes a lot of confidence to post a video of yourself singing to YouTube. But we had some fascinating spin-offs. There's a young woman who would play her viola. Instead of the lead vocals, she'd use her viola to actually mimic the lead vocals. It was fascinating. So the amount of creativity that was kind of spawned by this app environment was tremendous. But again, that was not the core product. That was a spin-off that we focused a lot of resources
on. And how long ago was this? This was what
it
was time 20, frame was it?
2012 to 2016.
Right. Okay, so about 7 years ago or so. So it's still when YouTube was still, it's not the way, it's I guess YouTube's evolved even past that point at this point now. Like, YouTube, that was like at the peak of everybody's like, oh my gosh, you can make $1 million on YouTube.
Right.
Yeah. And it was kind of like that was like the beginning when people, the general public was realizing that.
Really at the beginning of the influencer space too.
Exactly.
That's yeah. when it really was taking
yeah,
exactly. off.
That's what I was thinking of, yes.
People wanting to be influencers on all the different platforms, social media platforms.
Wow. Okay, so you started that, and then so why did you leave that to go do this business then?
So ultimately, that was winding down, okay. And I ended up working with an old colleague of mine who had started an agency in New York, so Development Shop. Mm-hmm. We say agency, just kind of shorthand, but we yeah. don't want it to be confused with like marketing or right, creative right. agency. Development Shop. But he basically, it had kind of grown from him being a freelancer to being a freelancer and working with a couple other shops. And he had basically become kind of the limiting factor in his own growth and success. So I came on to run client engagement and accounts there and do technical management while he was doing biz dev. Craig came on to take over more biz dev. We worked there for a while and eventually kind of just wanted to be back out here in New Jersey and really run our own show. So that started just about a year ago. TechNeed is just about a year. We probably need to have like a 1 year birthday party.
I think
right?
so. Yeah.
yeah
well, congratulations. It's hard to get past the first year. I mean,
thank you.
It is.
I mean, I own a business, but I didn't start the business. So okay. I'm always fascinated with the origin story kind of things of how people make that step. I mean, I had to make a leap in that I was going from not owning a business to running a business that I didn't even, wasn't even part of at that point. So, mm-hmm. like, so, you know, real quick, it was like 25 years, though, into their business. So it wasn't like, you know, there was not a lot of unknowns.
It was sure. established.
Yeah, it was all established. Yeah. There's customers. And but that has its own problem set, too, because then you have expectations to manage that, you know, aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And then not as many eyeballs, or more eyeballs on you than, say, when you're starting out brand new. So, you know, but I'm like, so what's that day when you said, okay, we're going to do this on our, was that your decision then at that point? Or did you guys just get together and say, okay, we're going to do this?
I think it was kind of a thing we had thought about, but eventually just decided like, you know, it's the right time to strike out, on our own. I think really it, look, to kind of tie it back into my history, I've got a 20 plus year history in software engineering. So, classically trained in computer science mm-hmm. and jumped right into the workforce and the entrepreneur pool, mm-hmm. Hands-on software engineering, kind of worked my way up from individual contributor on a team to team lead, tech lead, eventually running software engineering operations, mm-hmm. managing multiple teams. And one of the things that I really committed myself to in that journey was the idea of operating at a more strategic level, because basically the observation is, you can write beautiful software. I wrote tons of code, tons and tons of code. I managed teams with people who were like truly brilliant and wrote beautiful code and achieved amazing things. But if you're solving the wrong business problems or solving them in the wrong way, mm-hmm. then success is just as far out of reach as it ever has been. So basically, like, tremendous execution isn't going to overcome a strategy problem. Mm-hmm. So my commitment at some level was to operate strategically and try to do that both internally, you know, for our company when we were both FTEs at a shop, mm-hmm. But then also in the software vendor space or software services space to operate strategically on behalf of our clients. So basically, the thing that distinguishes us from any other development shop, a traditional development shop, is we're not just taking blueprints and mm-hmm. building them. We actually jump in and we try to, as you said at the beginning, right, work closely with our clients to internalize their priorities and goals and really re-examine them. Like, actually go back and do the, like, start with why kind of
problem. Why are you using this software? Why are you using...
What problem are you trying to solve? Yeah. What need are you addressing in the market? How are you going to monetize it? What's your business strategy? What's your user acquisition strategy? What's your revenue model? What's your value proposition to the end user? Whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Go through those steps because in the end, those are the things that matter. The execution comes. Basically, I've been doing this long enough that mm-hmm. the execution's there.
Yeah.
You have to be solving the right problem in the first place, though.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break. And then we'll get back into it. So let me see. Got my list of commercials I got to run. And I guess the next to tease after the break, we'll talk about maybe what your who your first customer was and
sure.
If there's a story behind that. And we'll go from there. All right. Hold on.
Oh, folks, you know what that music is. That's the time for modern design.
This blue thing is a really new trend. A lot of the designers are trying to introduce blue as a new cabinet color.
This is topical for you guys. This is really topical.
And the mother said, well, I'd like her room to be gray. And the little girl said, Mom, gray is the color of depression.
Hi, this is Rich Scuderi of Modern Design. We're on live every Wednesday from 2 to 3, and you're listening on WHCR-DB.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provides sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care at a moment's notice. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care.
All right, we're back here. Hack Hunterdon Radio, Jim and Audio. We got Craig and we got Brandon. Brandon or Brendan?
Brendan.
Brendan.
Sorry.
I knew as soon as I said it. I knew I said it. I was like, that's not right.
Anything that starts with BR.
Well, you have like sort of two first names, right? Elliot, Brendan, right?
Yep. Could go either way.
I went to school with a guy. His name was Wallace Henry. Okay. And the substitute teachers always used to call him Henry Wallace.
Yep.
Because they thought they screwed up the roster.
Right.
Totally. So, yeah. So all right. So getting back into it. So. We were talking about the origins of TechNeed and where you started. So I wanted to find out, like I've been asking other people that I interview, who, like, you don't have to give out the exact details, but like how the story of your first customer, like how did you, because that's obviously how your business got started. So
sure. Yeah, so I think when we were back trying to figure out if we wanted to make this a real business and go ahead and take the leap, we obviously first started with our network and tapping people who we thought might be helpful to get introductions to or understand a little bit more about the landscape there. So I had reached out to a few people in my network, had a lot of coffees, had a lot of lunches, and basically found someone at a financial services firm who was willing to introduce us to some of his clients. Mm-hmm. And so from there, we took a few meetings and basically found one of the clients to be a perfect fit for someone that could use our services and really transform their business, not just from a technology standpoint, but mm-hmm. really, like we said before, kind of reevaluating what their goals were and how they were going to achieve them and just kind of started from scratch, went in, had a full day session with them and kind of just beat up the idea and what they were trying to achieve. And
so what kind of mistakes were they making that you were able to see, you know, from that kind of introduction? Like, so if somebody, you know, it kind of leads to, like, if I brought you into my company, what kind of things are you looking at specifically?
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. So, look, there can be all kinds of flaws or faults. And it's something that we've come to focus on more and more recently, is actually the idea of doing like a business process consulting, but specifically for software technology-based companies. Mm-hmm. And I will come back to the specific questions about that client, but basically there are frequently fundamental issues in a lot of organizations around communication, information sharing, and information organization, mm-hmm. coordination in general. So those are endemic, right?
It's hard because it's you start collecting data, like even like using our company as an example. We're a small office. There's basically three of us that share most of the data, and then there's other people that share bits of the other data, right? Mm-hmm. So, but it's like one is easy because it's, you know, you can put stuff wherever you want it. Two is almost just as easy because you could just say, okay, I put it here. If I didn't put it there, then she put it there. But when you start getting three, then it's like it's an exponential level of problem of, okay, three people managing the same set of data. So I can see where, you know, you guys coming in, that's like the first thing. Like, how are you managing that communication of all the data?
Yeah, exactly. And it is a problem that we have been forced to solve for ourselves because we work with distributed teams. And we're not all in the same office. So Craig and I are in an office in Hopewell mm-hmm. Borough. But then our other partner, we should say his name at least, Roman Punsky.
yeah, give a shout out to Roman.
Roman. Roman's a great guy. Roman and I have actually worked, I think I've worked with Roman longer than anybody else I've worked with in my career. Roman and I started working together.
Oh, wow.
Writing turn by turn GPS software way back in the day and shipped one of the earliest turn by turn nav apps on the iPhone.
Oh, wow.
He's a great guy and is a real wizard with technology. But he's in London.
Okay. So he's your London office.
Yeah. And then a lot of the we do work with, we're very open about this, we work mm-hmm. With vendor partners, mm-hmm. Partner agencies. Basically, we vetted a group of agencies really around the world, I'll say, like mm-hmm. Central and South America, but also Eastern Europe,
mm-hmm.
and that allows us to kind of offer our strategic vision and our instrumentation of product roadmap, but it allows us to then bring costs down by bringing the actual like implementation costs down at the software developer level.
Yeah, so, side note, like you're the third that right off the top of my head that I've interviewed that does the same kind of thing, yeah. even in their industry. So like the last couple that was here from the response work, they do like employment assistance programs, and it's the same thing. It's like they're a two-person company, but then they vet other providers like mm-hmm. social workers and psychologists and people who can go into disasters because yeah. they have to respond around the world. So you're you can't be a 40,000 person company,
right?
So to handle every single problem, so yeah, that it's becoming. I don't think you have to apologize for that. I think that's becoming more the model of how things are working in all sorts of technology.
Sure.
It's interesting.
Yeah, and we really don't. We're very upfront with our clients, and even when we're courting opportunities, you know, mm-hmm. We don't apologize. We use it as a selling. We don't apologize for it. We use it as a selling point.
Yeah.
But what it demands from us is that we actually have really good organization and communication because we're working on multiple projects at once with multiple teams, right? So everything has to be tuned up. You know, you can't drop the ball on a daily basis, right? And I'm looking at four projects concurrently. I've got to, you know, do my stand-up for this one, get everything in order, get my notes, rearrange my, you know, tickets in the task management system or whatever, mm-hmm. and then go straight on to the next one. Everybody's got to be on the same page in terms of the way the workflow works, the way the communication priorities work, all the rest of that. So that's caused us to have to basically really think about and solve that problem for ourselves, and we discovered, hey, we can actually market that and sell that as a business service to other folks who need it, because honestly, everybody needs it.
That's what I'm saying. It's becoming an issue where you know, companies need that skill, and there's so many options, like just, you know, the popular tools like Slack or something,
yep.
or even things like Salesforce, and mm-hmm. you know, you could even use QuickBooks has its own CRM. I mean, there's mm-hmm. so many different things. You could use Office, and now they, Microsoft's getting into Teams, right?
Yeah. Right. And so if you look at the landscape of how businesses have gone, in specifically speaking about startups, there used to be a lot of large companies and a few startups, and now there's a ton of startups, and the bigger companies are dwindling. But with that momentum, you're getting a lot of really fast-paced environment, younger, ambitious people to do a lot at once. And in order to do that, well, you really have to be organized and have a process to what you're doing. So
yeah, and have the, even if you have that, you still have to have the technical ability to focus. Like you were saying, you know, I have this project and I have this project. This, you know, I'm not gonna, the creep is not gonna let me screw up another project because right. I'm mm-hmm. wasting time on this. So
it's, yeah, I mean, a handful of skills, and they apply in software, but they apply everywhere.
Right.
Number one is get stuff done. Yeah. You know, that's like a classic mantra.
Yeah.
But do the most important things first. You know, like it really takes prioritizing roadmap. And I always say in software, like, you know, we do agile scrum, so we work on sprint basis. We actually try to keep it pretty tight and do like 1 week sprints, maybe 2 week sprints. But that means you're doing a week's worth of work, and you really set out in front of yourself, all right, this is what we're going to do. Imagine this is the last week we could ever work on this project. What are the things we'd want to get done to leave as our legacy? You know, and of course you have to mix that in with some strategic kind of architectural vision
right.
planning, but you're always examining what's the next most important thing that we have to do, and how can we knock it out quickly? How can we basically get to a result, an achievable result quickly?
Yeah, so that's actually a good segue back into our first client.
That's right. Okay, so.
Right, so.
It was your story, though. Was it?
Go ahead.
No, you can speak to that better.
So, great client opportunity. I mean, it was a warm introduction, and they were in an exciting space. So they had been running a website that did ratings and reviews for kids after school and extracurricular activities, everything from sports to music lessons to dance, like the stuff you can think of when you've got kids who are somewhere between, you know, like...
So like an Angie List for after school.
Like Yelp.
Yeah, exactly.
Yelp or, yeah, okay.
But they had an ambition to turn it into more than that, really as a revenue opportunity. So they wanted to turn it into a registration portal because so many of these businesses, look, they're small businesses run by people who are not necessarily tech savvy.
Mm-hmm.
These businesses are taking phone calls for registrations. They're taking paper checks. Like,
sometimes it's just like a little township or something that has mm-hmm. a rec department. They want to have five different soccer teams, you know, having the registration, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Right. So centralize all of that. Do list your offerings via the site with very specific things like, you know, date and time, recurrence, all the rest mm-hmm. of that, age range, gender, you know, category, subject matter, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then allow registration and payment processing via the site, right? Mm-hmm. Great idea, right? Because nobody's going to go set that up on their own. There are plugins for WordPress that could let you do it. But even so, you know, as a parent, honestly, it's frustrating. You go to somebody's website, they're a dance studio or something like that. Now I have to go and try and figure out, all right, well, where do I sign up? It's not a standardized interface. It looks different on every site. Then you're like, do I really want to put my credit card information in here? Like, do I know what plugin they're using underneath it to process payments? Like, all right, we'll see. Maybe I'll just hold off. Maybe I'll just call.
Yeah, like I do a volleyball thing at Clinton Township, and I remember when their first website, the guy who ran it would send us screenshots and say, okay, even though it says this, do this. Like, what kind of software is that?
Where it's
like, even though it says, you know, you're a parent of the athlete, you are the parent. So just put your name twice and that's okay.
Right.
Like, you know, stuff like that. So, I could totally appreciate that problem.
It's quirky, right?
Yeah.
So the idea was to standardize and kind of capture that space to help these businesses kind of modernize, but by offering them a valuable service along the way. Because then on top of that, once you've gotten people to register and pay through the site, now you turn around to the business, you say, well, look, this is your roster for this class. You can do like every, you can do attendance, you print out your roster and you know who's going to be coming to a given class and all kinds of stuff. So
is this their vision and then you implemented their vision, or is this something you helped create with them, their vision?
So we helped fine tune that vision because like a lot of other early stage entrepreneurs, they kind of had a big plate of ideas and a lot of things weren't necessarily clear. Should we do this first? Should we try that first? It's like, all right, one of the exercises we go through right off the bat is what's really important, like what's your mission? We actually go kind of, it's silly, but it's like business school 101 stuff. Like, what's your mission statement? What are your like four key objectives, right?
And then SWOT analysis and all that other stuff.
Exactly. And how are we gonna get there? How are we gonna get to the most important thing? So we end up then, we go through a process, and again, this is a service that we retail to our clients, of documenting all this. So we've got a pretty, I would say, reasonably lightweight and compact process and document that we produce that catalogs, all that information identifies, you know, classes of user in the system. So you've got a business offering, a business that offers a service, right? And then you've got parents who register for the service. You've got kids who are actually enrolled for the classes. And then we document below that, you know, objects and entities in the system and the relationships between objects and entities, you know, many to many, one to one, all the rest of that. And then other attributes of all of these objects and entities and users. And then we go through a process where we just write out user stories. And user stories are the unit of work in a software engineering system.
Yeah. So I was curious, like in your case, since you're contracting to somebody else, they own the software once you develop it.
Yeah.
How much can you use that for another client?
No, so in general, unless we come to the table with a framework that we've already built or worked on, then we're not going to reuse it. So all of our contracts specifically assign ownership of all intellectual property, source code, algorithms, whatever, to the client. That's not our business. We're not trying to collect patents or reusable code. In fact, the way that the software world has gone, I think we'll wind up covering this a little more in the next segment, is that a lot more of what we do is framework-based. Okay. So we're not creating nearly as much code from whole cloth as you would have 5, 10, 20 years ago.
Okay. Well, that's a good point to stop then because we are at another break point. Like I said, it goes by really fast, faster than you think sometimes. And then we'll get back and we'll talk about what you guys see for the future of your industry. So let me find my commercial.
Oh, folks, there you know what that music is. That's the time for Modern Design. This blue thing is a really new trend. A lot of the designers are trying to introduce blue as a new cabinet color.
This is topical for you guys. This is really topical.
And the mother said, well, I'd like her room to be gray. And the little girl said, Mom, gray is the color of depression.
Hi, this is Rich Scuderi of Modern Design. We're on live every Wednesday from 2 to 3, and you're listening on WHCR-DB.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
For over 50 years, Hunterdon Medical Center has been a leader in delivering comprehensive medical and health services to our community. Our staff is committed to providing the highest quality of care to our patients. If you need a physician, we can refer you to over 300 of the best. Call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org. When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provides sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care at a moment's notice. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care.
What do you want to do when you grow up? When we were young, it's a question we were often asked. As we get older, our passions become clearer, our pursuits become careers, and if we're diligent, we begin to plan for the life we want to live. That's why, at Ameriprise Financial, we ask what's most important to you. Starting with our confident retirement approach, your Ameriprise Financial Advisor will ask questions that help you arrive at a customized plan that allows you to realize your goals today, tomorrow, and throughout retirement. With the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Call Michelle Heidi and Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 16 Lee Street, Units 1B and 1C in Clinton, New Jersey. The confident retirement approach is not a guarantee of future financial results. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
All right, we're back to Hack Hunterdon Radio. I'm your host again, Jim Minadio. I'm here with Brendan and Craig from TechNeed. So we're finishing up our last segment, and I guess before I get to the historical story, we're going to talk about the future of your business, like what you see moving forward. So what do you so in your line of business? We talked a little bit about, you know, there's a lot of smaller companies doing this kind of work because it's kind of like as needed by these other larger companies maybe, or even other smaller companies. So like you're my, so my analogy that I have in my head is like, as a, I make a physical product. So I have supply costs of just consumables that go into making the product.
But then every now and then, I'll need to buy a piece of equipment. So that's my capital cost.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of guys are like the software version of the capital cost. Because you come in, you do these big projects, and that's going to service something later down the road.
Yeah, I think that's certainly one way of looking at it. The other way is that we are either augmenting or replacing an in-house FTE staff. Because, I mean, full-time employees are expensive, and it turns out, generally speaking, you have to hire them in like whole number of units.
Yeah.
But if you're running a software project, it may be that you need like 25% of a project manager's time and 20% of a designer's time and 40% of a DevOps guy's time, whatever. We can't hire them like that if you're staffing in-house, right? So we actually have like an infographic and that we've done that shows, you know, why your overage in overhiring, even when you're only staffing one, really could matter to your bottom line. I mean, these are expensive resources. Like a fully qualified DevOps guy is expensive.
It's the same thing as buying a big piece of. I could buy a 3D printer to do a little bit of prototyping, but if I only use that once a week,
yep.
Why don't I just go to a guy who has a 3D printer?
Sure,
that I can
exactly.
Use? So it's the same concept,
right?
But I guess because you guys don't do once the project's over, you're not coming back. Other than to do other projects, right? You're not managing that project once it's...
We're happy to. So actually, we love support and maintenance.
Do? Okay.
Sure. So continuing to support a product after it's launched, I mean, honestly, one of the funny things about it, you have to make a mental shift when you think about shipping a product. So if you start from concept to creation, right? Okay. Everyone's like, all right, we hit launch day. That's actually the beginning of your life.
Okay.
Right? It's like for... You know, for everybody who hasn't done it before, right, having a kid, having your first kid, you're like, I know all the things I'm going to do when, you know, we have our kid, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to raise him like that. Turns out that all goes out the window.
Right,
in your first month or two of, like, taking care of either a newborn baby or a freshly launched product, you rethink everything, right? Because you're dealing with immediate necessities on a day-by-day basis.
Every day? For the first couple of weeks,
And also, I mean, if you compare it to even buying a house, I think I use this one a lot. You know, purchasing the house is one cost,
right.
You know, aka purchasing the initial product that you're having us build. But it's not like you don't have to pay utility bills, taxes,
right.
The water heater goes. I mean, things like that happen. Yeah, exactly.
In the end, the real value of having a launched product, especially in the software space, is actually understanding the way your users use the product and then adapting the product to be more useful to them.
Okay.
So actually the only goal of launching is to learn what your users really want to do, because before you launch a product, it's just you and a few other people talking in a circle.
And you can only test so much.
Yep.
A customer will always find a way to use your product that you never thought of.
Right.
Exactly.
I mean, always. Because I've done it too as the user to say, like, hey, can I do... And I've called up for support for different things. I'm like, we've never used our software to do that before.
Right.
That's like... Oh, well, maybe you should make it do it that way, you know?
Exactly. Or that one feature that you really invested in as the product developer that then nobody uses and they're all focused over here. All right, well, so maybe that atrophies and we let it go or whatever, spin it out, let it be its own thing.
So what do you see as the future of this industry then as far as software development?
Sure, yeah. So I think that's the way to look at it, right? So we are a software development agency, but more broadly speaking, in the industry of software creation, there's just an amazing phenomenon that's going on, which is... everybody relies more and more on frameworks and cross-platform technologies. So I'm talking about things that let you develop once but run the application on both iOS and Android. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to write a custom application on iOS and a custom application on Android, doubling your software engineering costs.
And maintenance.
Support and maintenance. And your the rise of cloud and especially serverless technologies, where you don't have to stand up a server, even if it runs in AWS. Guess what? If it's still its own server, you still have to pay for it when it's not being used, and so on and so forth. So, between platforms and frameworks and serverless technologies that make it easier to develop software, what's really happening is you're transforming the market. Which 10, 20 years ago was a market of, can it even be done? Or can I do it on a budget? I've got to hire 20 engineers. We've got to work from the ground up, create from whole cloth, solve all these problems that are really just mechanical problems that get me to the business solution I'm looking for. Nowadays, you're actually operating in a marketplace of ideas where it's relatively easy to get to the business solution because the frameworks offer so much. What that's doing is it's really just working out for the end user. The products that you're using now actually deliver you the value that you really want, and there are so many more of them, and the market is surfacing the ones that are actually solving the problem correctly. It's not just dealing with clunky, buggy software that happens to be the only solution out there to the one thing that you were looking for.
So if it doesn't work, it's a Darwinian kind of thing where the strongest software is going to survive. And so it'll float to the top, and everybody be like, okay, yeah, we need scheduling software. This is the guy that you got to talk to.
Right, and it has become a place where, I mean, this is what we anticipate, and this is why we offer product strategy as, like, our keystone service, because in the end, product strategy is the differentiator, right? The people can create software now. You have to be creating the right software that's pleasing, I would say even delightful, for the end user to use,
right,
that has a strong value proposition, that extracts revenue appropriately, delivers value appropriately. You do those things, you know, and you're winning. Delight, you can't underestimate end user delight.
Can you do that without the experience? Like, you know, I mean, will it ever be the point where an 18-year-old programmer could do this? Because it sounds like some of what you guys are doing, you know, is what you add for the value is the fact that you have the experience to do the business. To be able to do a business analysis, I don't care if you just learned it in school, you're not going to be able to have that experience. You know, you're not going to be able to draw some of your own personal experience and your own business experience.
Right.
Sure.
So is that something that you, I mean, is there any way that would ever happen? Or is that you're always going to need seasoned people to be able to do these kind of...
Look, I mean, I think that young people can always do brilliant stuff. And we work with plenty of young people who are brilliant. But there is some idea of, I don't want to necessarily call it wisdom or whatever, but it's just perspective. You've lived some life. You've seen some things. You develop that intuition.
I think what it is like the human, we still have value as humans is what I'm getting to. Like, we have, you know, you could have a database full of great software that, you know, you can go online and see every software that's ever been made and do research on it. But it still doesn't. It still needs to have a human to be able to say, "Oh yeah, that software is clunky, or that software has a lot of user interface problems because you know people don't like it because you have to click here, then you have to click here, and those kind of like those things." I think like almost like you can't have robotic software. It's almost like in manufacturing, always tied to what we do. Like you know, there's robots that are out there that can do some of the stuff, but they can't make our product.
Right.
Yeah, because they just can't do the human things.
Yep.
Like even Elon Musk found, like when he built the Tesla, that he made this whole robotic thing for putting insulation inside a door, and he found that humans were faster and better at doing it than robots.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, because there's some intuition kind of thing that you do.
You're absolutely right. And I mean, one of the areas that we really like to work in or work near is finding opportunities to modernize kind of antiquated or niche industries, because there's a strange paradox there, right? If you've got some niche industry that's been run on pencil and paper for years, but it's broadly applied, you know, it exists all over the place. It takes practitioners in that industry who are aware of technology possibilities to even draw them in.
Right.
But yes, you're absolutely right. It still takes that human intuition saying like, hey, look, there's something that we've been doing less effectively than we could, and we can actually revolutionize some niche industry and say, turn around and offer that as a service to our competitors or something like that. Yeah. It does always take a human perspective. You're
that's
absolutely right.
Broadly called digital transformation. That's the key word going around these days. I mean, it really applies to a number of different businesses, their problems, what they're currently doing, where they could be. And I think one of the things that we're very aware of is when advising certain clients to, let's say, adopt a certain platform or framework, making sure that it kind of slides into their day-to-day and not something that is too abrupt and makes all of their employees want to pull their hair out because they're forced to use this new system. Rather, we want them to welcome it and adopt it and use it to their advantage so that the software is working for them and it frees up their time to focus on their real job, where they're probably just spending 20-30% of their day doing mundane tasks that could be done either automatically or, you know, however. But it frees up the time, and then therefore obviously makes them more productive, and everybody's happy.
Broadly speaking, we just call that appropriate use of technology. So we're not trying to like stuff technology, you know, like impose it on people. It's just, hey, there are solutions that can help you act more effectively. Not only that, appropriate use of technology is actually pretty attractive to a younger generation of employees. They want to be using newer platforms, newer methods, newer technologies, even processes and practices in the business place. Makes you an attractive employer to do it. So.
Yeah, I've been trying. I mean, I've been using computer. Like, I have my first emails from 1986.
Yeah.
So University of Delaware had email back then, and they
were using Pine email client.
No, I don't remember. It was on a VAX server of some kind.
All right.
I remember the before even Excel, it was called 2020.
Okay.
Was the spreadsheet software,
right?
And we even had instant messaging. If you were on the network, you can, and you knew the computer person's number or whatever, you could say, you know, hey, you want to get coffee or something.
Right.
And across the computer lab from somebody, you'd see their head pop up. Like, who did that?
Yeah.
So that goes way back. But the point is, it's, you know, I'm starting to get to the point, I just turned 50, where, like, I'm starting to look at, oh, we're going to have to implement Windows 10 now. Like, what am I going to have to learn now to do that? Or, you know, because that if we do that, now we're going to upgrade our QuickBooks to this version. And it's like, just kind of like, at some point, I've learned so many softwares over 30 years of my life. It's like, so I guess that's something that I can see if you're in an industry that's, say, older, and they've already done, you know, they went through DOS, they went through you know, Windows, and now they're doing, you know, Windows 10. It's like, things like that, like, they don't want to do that. So you have to be very cognizant of that and say, hey, maybe this isn't appropriate for you. But when the next generation comes, they're going to need to know that. So they need to, you know, how do you deal with a business that has both those kind of levels of people? You have the young kids that are ready to do whatever, and then, you know, everything's on their phone, and, you know, versus people like me. So
it is a part of that initial assessment, right? So I just kind of call it the, you know, client read. Like, what are they ready to adopt? So when we do that assessment, we typically, we jump right in and say, hey, here's some stuff we're going to act on right away. We're going to actually get you, you know, stood up. You said Slack before. We're going to get you up on Slack by the end of the day today, right? Because it's that easy. Yeah. We can do it, and we can make it fun, and you're going to love using emojis. So you're going to enjoy it. Then there's a set of kind of homework actions. These are things the client should be able to do on their own. Let's lay out some priorities you're going to achieve. And then there's a set of deferred actions. It's like, okay, so you're a Microsoft house, right? It's like, do you want to entertain the idea of moving over to Google and Google Drive and Google Docs and G Suite in general? All right, let's defer that. That's something that's not going to work right now, but 6 months down the road, we'll revisit that question and talk about it then.
Okay. All right, so we're already at the end of it. I mean, this is, like I said, this runs fairly fast.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you need to say before we get into this history story?
I'm dying to hear the answer
to
that.
Okay, so it's Heartbleed.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So I found this story on, there's a website, I guess it's through slate.com, but it's their future tense column. And so it was an article about the lesson about how just because code works for a long time doesn't mean it's perfectly good.
Yep.
And that's what Heartbleed. So for people who don't know, Heartbleed was a vulnerability in the open source SSL software, right? So many websites were using it. Other online applications were using it. And did you guys ever use
OpenSSL? Yeah, of course.
Everybody used it, right? I mean, that's why it was the most widely distributed software for this. It's for encryption, right?
Yep.
So so one of the lessons was that, I guess, the vulnerability was there for a long time, and people didn't know until somebody found it. And then they reported it. And then all of a sudden, people were like, oh, we can exploit this now. So then people had to fix it. And so do you guys get involved with that kind of stuff, with cybersecurity?
We don't, but we've got a really good intro for you. If you want to talk to folks, actually, we're in a neat little office space in Hopewell Borough, and our immediate next-door neighbors are actually their cybersecurity firm.
Okay. So then they could probably talk more about this.
They would love this.
So, yeah. So basically, the story was... I guess because it was an issue to do with C programming, right? Because it addresses with C, what's different is that it you have to control the memory of data. So you have to tell it when to turn memory on and off and when to use it, when to let it be overwritten and things like that. And so it was leaving that that functioning open for exploitation.
Yeah, it was like one of those various buffer overflows.
Not getting into all the details because we have a couple minutes. So I'm trying to give a rundown of this. So so what people have learned, you know, and what people still haven't learned is, I mean, you have people like the Equifax breach was basically, you know, when you have software that has issues in it and vulnerabilities, and then it's reported, you have to jump on it right away is the lesson. Because Equifax, they just left things open, right? They didn't, and that was like one of the biggest breaches recently.
So, there are other people who can speak to this a lot more. I actually did a long, long time ago did cryptography and digital rights management. But in a way, the takeaways are everything's vulnerable. Yeah. There's no such thing as perfect software. Everything will be breached at some point. Typically, white hat hackers will actually let someone know, give them a heads up before going public with information so that they can attempt to remedy before the information becomes public. But that doesn't always serve as quite enough of an incentive, especially for much larger
companies. What
happened
out of this was... Red Hat, right, owns Linux, right? So, or they
make a Linux, yeah.
They run, no, it wasn't Red Hat then. I'm sorry. It was I should have highlighted it because I knew it for, if I can find it right. Oh, the Linux Foundation, that's what it was. So after Heartbleed, they got together with Amazon, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, got each of them to donate money to work on this open source vulnerability issue. Because that's the problem. It's like, it's not like Microsoft having a vulnerability in, you know, their operating system. They just, their engineer tells them, or they get a white hat or somebody tells them, they'll patch it before they tell the world.
Right.
Right. Like what you just said. But the problem with open source software is there's nobody that runs them. Everybody's managing it. So then if somebody who are you supposed to go to? If you're a white hat, how do you tell, who do you tell? You know,
some project lead even on open source projects, but it does highlight the central fallacy. I mean, one of the kind of theories of open source software is many eyes makes the software better, but it turns out like we're all humans, and actually the patterns that we overlook tend to be the same.
Right.
So problems can persist through to production even in open source.
There's the whole management aspect of it that. Because it's open source, there's no one big, you know, overseer that says, hey, let's fix this now. Or let's, you know, the group think, you have to allow the group think to take care of that. But then it also, they're not going to notify other people, hey, this open source software didn't work.
Right. You know,
so that's what this task force created, that Linux created. So to try to help bridge that gap, that vulnerability gap, that when there is a vulnerability, they're going to notify people. You know, this is the fix, patch now or else. So that's the little story for today. All right, so we're at the end of the show. So I have a little. Here's my little. All right. So thank you, Brandon. I thought I put Brandon. Oh, because I know a Brandon. That's probably why. Brandon, I'll get it right. Thank you. Right.
Yep.
See you guys maybe tomorrow at the meetup.
You got it? We'd love to. We'd love to try and make it.
So, definitely. So come.
I try and make it.
Thanks to all the new fans on Facebook, the Chamber, for giving me the opportunity to do this. Mark and his team at Economic Development for their encouragement and support. The Gang Back at Zero Surge, Donna, Deb, Jen, Tony, Dave, and John, my wife, kids, and to all the rest of you innovators out there, the original meaning of innovator was that you are a rebel. So keep rebelling against the doubters and make your ideas a reality. And that's the show.